Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the U.S. Supreme Court is increasingly being seen as political. Pundits and news reports frequently call out the conservative court for its rulings as wins and losses for political parties. But is that really the case? Actually, President Donald Trump has lost more cases before the court than any other president. Community conversation, we want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In the next half hour, we're going to be joined by District 4 Councilmember Edward Munguia to talk about Project Marvel and how we could be voting for it in the next bond election. But first, the U.S. Supreme Court, many see the justices as politicians in black robes and that they make their decisions that directly impact our lives based on red versus blue ideology. And they also think that the nine Supremes, or at least a few of them, have given up on calling balls and strikes when it comes to the Constitution. But Sarah Eisger says that is bogus. She is the author of a new book, Last Branch Standing, a potentially surprising, occasionally witty journey through today's Supreme Court. She's also the editor of the SCOTUS blog. And Sarah, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start off by talking about how Donald Trump is the biggest loser before the Supreme Court and what that says about your premise.
So in his first term in office, Donald Trump broke a record. In American history, he was the first president ever to lose more than win at the U.S. Supreme Court, falling below 50%. Barack Obama, Joe Biden both had better win records at the Supreme Court. And I think it just really undermines this narrative that we are told constantly that Donald Trump is constantly winning at the Supreme Court and that the justices, you know, do Trump's bidding. When you think about Trump's major policy initiatives that have wound up at the court in the last year, Alien Enemies Act on immigration, nope, the Supreme Court said. Federalizing the National Guard, nope. Tariffs, nope. And then birthright citizenship, I don't think you can find a legal expert here that will tell you that he's likely to win that case.
So the Supreme Court is not in the tank for Donald Trump. So why do they have this idea that the justices are doing his bidding?
So last term, 9% of the cases decided by the court were 6-3 along ideological lines, meaning 91% of the cases weren't and didn't fit that narrative. But, you know, we live in an era where you have both sides of the political spectrum in this kind of war of all against all, against one another, where they're pulling the Supreme Court into these political fights. Nobody expects Congress to do their job anymore. Nobody thinks that we, the people, can amend the Constitution. And so the Supreme Court, that was supposed to be part of this democratic dialogue, becomes the last word. And if the Supreme Court's the last word, then it's going to really matter who those justices are, how they're ruling. And so it becomes part of our political partisan fight, when in fact, the court historically is supposed to be an independent counter-majoritarian institution. And my argument in the book, at least, is they're actually doing that about right. Doesn't mean you can't disagree with some decisions. I do all the time. But compared to Congress and the presidency, the Supreme Court's looking like the only branch the founders would recognize today.
So, but people may say when it comes to things, certain things, that the high court is in the tank for Donald Trump or at least the Republican Party, particularly when it comes to voting rights.
Yeah, I mean, this is the big cases argument, right? They're like, yeah, sure, it's only 9% of the time that it's 6-3 along ideological lines, but those are the cases that I care about. You know, some of that is certainly true. 9% isn't nothing, by the way. So yes, there are decisions that are made along ideological grounds. I would still separate that from partisanship. But the problem is we often define the big cases by which ones turn out to be 6-3. So last term, for instance, there was a case on gun manufacturer liability. This idea of whether Mexico could sue Smith & Wesson for gun deaths in the country of Mexico. This is a big question, right? About whether you can sue gun manufacturers?
It seemed pretty much like a gimme, like a layup, like that was going to be a hard no.
Well, so it was unanimous, and the court said no, and Justice Sotomayor wrote the decision. But here's my argument to you. If that had been a 6-3 decision, it would be considered the biggest decision of last term, even with the same outcome, because it would have fallen along those ideological lines, and the Smith & Wesson case would be treated the same as Citizens United when it comes to gun violence.
I don't buy it. I don't see it that way.
I mean, there were several unanimous cases last term that people thought were big cases until they came out to be unanimous. There was one on employment discrimination, reverse discrimination about heterosexuals discriminated by homosexuals, written by Justice Jackson. That wasn't considered big once it was written by her.
Right.
There was
so when
a case
people
about
are focused on
liberty
outcome and not process,
yes,
that's where they get thrown off.
Yeah, exactly. It's always about outcome, which is nothing new in our history. You go back to Chief Justice John Marshall in, you know, the 1801, and what people were saying about the Supreme Court then. Jefferson railed against the Supreme Court. He wanted to impeach Marshall. He, in fact, did get his party to impeach Justice Samuel Chase. And it reads very modern to us today because, yeah, people care about the outcomes, but the court is supposed to be about process. It's supposed to stand up against the bare and fleeting majorities of the day, and that's how it gets legitimacy over time. We wouldn't have a First Amendment. We wouldn't have a process for criminal defendants if we just had the court decide whatever the most popular outcome is.
So I get it why the Supreme Court makes certain rulings, why the Supreme Court ruled that the president can't be, you know, prosecuted for doing things that and his own duty. You know, people are outraged that you have created a king through this ruling. But, you know, you would you want to have the following president bring the previous president up on charges for some sort of COVID or whatever thing that they did to keep the country safe, as long as they were acting in good faith and not trying to privatize the power of the presidency? These things make sense when you think about it.
Yeah, you know, that case, Trump versus United States, Donald Trump was being indicted for his role in January 6th. The Supreme Court sort of laid out this new framework for how to think about indicting former presidents, you know, official acts, unofficial acts. And then the Department of Justice reindicted Donald Trump on the exact same four statutory charges, as in DOJ did not think that that decision prevented them from charging Donald Trump for the same stuff.
Because he was acting as an independent candidate.
Right. He was. That was his unofficial duties. I would generally tell people, I just don't think we know what that decision actually decided, because we will need another president to be indicted. You know, here's an example. If Congress tomorrow passed a law that said if the president pardons someone, he can be indicted for that.
Well, if he profited from pardoning someone, then what about that?
Well, but give me just a second. What if they just said, we don't like the president's pardon power, and so we're going to make it a crime for him to use that pardon power. And then the next president pardons someone, and they charge him after he leaves office. I think we'd all say that that's ridiculous. Congress doesn't have the ability to pass that law constitutionally.
Sure, it's pretty clear-cut.
Yeah, that's one of the buckets that the Supreme Court's talking about, an official act that is a core constitutional duty that's laid out in the Constitution. That gray area is, it's not core, or like, yeah, he takes money for the pardon. Now what do we do? And what they said in that case was, yeah, we're going to have to like play that by ear. If it would prevent a future president from doing his job, you probably can't charge the former president. But as long as like some future president would be fine doing his job, then like, yeah, go for it. But again, until we have that example, I don't think we really know the contours of it.
All right, got to take a break here. We're going to come back talking about the Supreme Court and the new book, The Last Branch Standing, with Sarah Eisger. When I come back, I want to ask you about who is John Marshall Harland and what's up with his Bible. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Call in with your questions and comments about SCOTUS. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Sarah Eisger. She is the author of Last Branch Standing. It is not written like a legal book. It is pithy. It's funny. A lot of pop culture references. It's not written for lawyers. It's written for people like you and me. And she's making a point here that it's just not really reasonable to think that the Supreme Court is politicians in robes. They may have some ideological differences, but sometimes they cross over and it is full of surprises. And so I want to ask you about, Sarah, who was John Marshall Harlan? Why is he such a big deal with the Supreme Court today? And what's up with his Bible?
John Marshall Harlan was the sole dissenter in the case Plessy versus Ferguson, which upheld Louisiana's separate railroad case and ushered in a wave of Jim Crow era violence and lynchings and laws further deepening segregation in the United States. So John Marshall Harlan was the sole voice that got the Equal Protection Clause right, frankly. He is also the justice that every current justice wants to be. He is their North Star. It's this idea of standing up against the popular majorities of the time, the culture that you're born into, and simply saying what the law is. And so every justice, before they take their oath of office, signs their name into John Marshall Harlan's Bible, the flyleaf of his Bible. And when they sit around the conference room, which no one else is allowed into but the nine justices, to vote on the outcome of a case, it is John Marshall Harlan's portrait that they sit under. And it is, again, this idea of a counter-majoritarian court. And the letter that Frederick Douglass wrote to John Marshall Harlan after they lost Plessy versus Ferguson, he wrote, "One man with God is a majority." And that really is, I think, how the justices all see their jobs, that their job is not to, you know, navigate political waters, but simply to say what the law is, because they won't be judged by today's politics. They will be judged 10, 20, 100 years down the road of whether they got it right today. And you can't do that through opinion polling.
So
and
if I
just
told
a note on this that I think is sort of fun, you know, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, you know, appointed by the same president, they went to the same high school, had the same history teacher. These guys are ideologically both very conservative Federalist Society type guys. But last term, they were only on the same side 50% of the time. In fact, Justice Kavanaugh was more likely to be on the same side of Justice Kagan and Justice Sotomayor than he was with Justice Gorsuch. So you have to have some other theory of the case beyond the, you know, politicians in robes, as you said.
If I told a Supreme Court justice, if I wanted to insult him and I called him a Roger Tawney, would he be insulted?
Oh my gosh, that's the ultimate insult at the Supreme Court. Chief Justice Tawney was the guy who wrote the Dred Scott decision. You know, we can have lots of debates over the worst Supreme Court decisions, but nobody will argue over the number one worst Supreme Court decision. But Roger Tawney's a fascinating character. He had held all of these important positions. He had incredibly high popularity in the United States. He was also, by the way, morally opposed to slavery, had emancipated his slaves and paid them a lifetime pension. And yet, he's the guy who thinks he's going to solve the slavery problem for the United States and ends up causing the Civil War. So all of the justices want to be John Marshall Harlan, the sole dissenter in Plessy. And all of them want to never be seen as Roger Tawney, the guy who thinks he knows better and can solve the political problems of the country through a court opinion.
So how did ending the filibuster in the appointment process of Supreme Court justices, how did that change things?
I think the Supreme Court, the judiciary as a whole, has some real threats on the horizon, and this is one of them. I guess I disagree with most people on what those threats are who think that it's, you know, politics. But this is a real one, which is when we got rid of the filibuster in 2013 for lower court judges and then for Supreme Court justices in 2018, we moved from a model where any judge had to have votes from both parties a general election model, if you will, to a primary election model, where not only do you not have votes from the other party, you don't want votes from the other party. If you're a Republican nominee who has Chuck Schumer voting for you, oh no, that means he's not conservative enough. Why is Chuck Schumer voting for our guy? And so you end up with more and more outlier judges. Joe Biden's judges were more liberal than Obama's judges. Trump's judges are more conservative than George W. Bush's judges. I think this is bad for the judiciary. And when you add in the problem of forum shopping, that many of these times, especially when you're suing the president, you can pick where to sue and therefore almost pick exactly which judge you want to be in front of.
Right, some judge in Amarillo.
That's right. You could be the most fair judge in America, but if one side keeps picking you over and over and over again, people are simply not going to trust the outcome is actually a rule of law outcome.
So if we don't look at these justices as red versus blue, Republican, you're a Republican and you're the Democrat or whatever, how are we supposed to look at them, especially when they are making these decisions that really directly impact politics? And I'm thinking about like last night, Alabama,
yep,
the shadow docket. It stinks.
I don't disagree with you there. So here's my point to people. The Supreme Court is not the last word on anything in our government. Not anything. So if you hate partisan gerrymandering, guess what? Congress could pass a law this afternoon banning partisan gerrymandering. You don't like Donald Trump's birthright citizenship executive order? Congress can do that tomorrow. Immigration. There's a case pending about whether Donald Trump can stop people at the southern border who are applying for asylum. Oh, that's actually up to Congress. Whether Mississippi can accept mail-in ballots 5 days later, also up to Congress. And so again and again, people are sending their anger to the wrong branch of government because we no longer believe that Congress is where we will hash out these political differences that we have through compromise and negotiation and long-term stability. We're so accustomed now to government by executive order, we think the president just waves his magic executive order wand, and then the Supreme Court gives sort of a, you know, Roman emperor thumbs up, thumbs down on the gladiatorial, you know, field of battle, and that, I don't know, Congress is like a bunch of Instagram influencers. We as voters need to hold Congress responsible for doing their job because
sure, so they're a branch that is not standing. They're standing no. down or sitting or whatever.
Napping?
So, yeah, right. Like the Biden executive order tries to deal with student loan debt.
Right.
The Supreme Court says, no, you can't do that. There are limits to executive authority. But to me—
But Congress can. Like, right on
Yeah,
Biden's
but then we see a lot
orders.
Of leeway that Supreme Court is giving the executive authority under Trump.
I would argue that no. In fact, you have Biden's student loan debt forgiveness, his clean power plan, eviction moratorium, vaccine mandate, all of those struck down by the Supreme Court, which said Congress is welcome to do these things, but a president acting alone without Congress cannot. And here with Trump, again, Alien Enemies Act, federalizing the National Guard, tariffs, birthright citizenship, very similar. Where Trump has at least temporarily won at the Supreme Court is on the hiring and firing power within the executive branch. Joe Biden had these lawsuits as well. He tried to remove someone from a board that was supposed to be bipartisan, and that was upheld by the courts that Joe Biden could fire those people. Donald Trump is winning those cases too. So I think the Supreme Court has been very consistent over the two administrations, but obviously the partisan valence has flipped in terms of which cases people tend to care about.
The Supreme Court supposed to guard against bare and fleeting majorities. What does that mean?
So if it's a big majority that pops up on some issue, we can pass a constitutional amendment. So it doesn't matter what the Supreme Court says because we, the voters, have the last word in that. And if it's a long-term majority that lasts for decades, then your political party will eventually appoint enough justices to the Supreme Court to make that happen. So, you know, when FDR left office, 9 appointees on the Supreme Court were appointed by Democrats. As recently as 1992, 8 appointees to the Supreme Court were appointed by Republicans. So when one party sort of captures the majority for long periods of time, that also gets reflected in the Supreme Court on those specific issues. But the Supreme Court tends to be a lagging indicator of our politics, sort of reflecting whatever that majority was a decade, two decades ago.
It could be a very slow pendulum swing.
Opinion
can wave back and forth on a dime, but not the Supreme Court.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Yuval Levin said this, and I think it's a really good way to think about it. Congress is supposed to be forward-looking, future-looking. They're supposed to think about the problems we are going to face and legislate those. The president is supposed to be present tense, you know, execute those laws, conduct foreign affairs for the now. The court is supposed to be backward-facing, you know, righting wrongs from the past. But what we are asking the court to do today is to jump into these political debates and call, you know, who's going to win or lose today in that present tense. They're not made for that. They're not going to be very good at it. But we keep forcing them to do that again because we don't seem to care about electing members to Congress who actually want to, you know, do Congress.
But here we have a court. The Roberts Court has been gutting the Voting Rights Act. And people are saying that we have minority populations in the country, that they are being disenfranchised or their rights to vote are being submerged. I wonder if these decisions are eventually going to be seen in the same kind of category as, Plessy versus Ferguson.
Maybe. I'm a big fan of intellectual humility, this idea that, you know, Roger Taney thought he was right when he wrote Dred Scott. The seven justices who wrote the majority in Plessy versus Ferguson thought they were right. And, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a liberal hero.
The great dissenter.
John Marshall Harlan's the great dissenter. Oliver Wendell Holmes is the, you know, liberal stalwart who wrote Buck v. Bell upholding eugenics and saying that you could forcibly sterilize someone if you didn't, you know, like the genetic pool that they were going to be passing
on.
Three generations of imbeciles
is enough.
Yes. And so it's this idea of, you know, there is something that we are wrong about today, each one of us, and certainly the Supreme Court. And so to sort of have strong opinions but hold them loosely, I think is a key to the American experiment. So what is the thing that I'm in the seven on in, you know, Plessy? Is it voting rights? Is it immigration? Is it abortion? You know, whatever it may be, I'm very willing to say I could just be totally, horribly wrong. And in 50 years, everyone's going to know I was wrong. And I hope that they will treat me with some of the grace that I'll treat some of our historical predecessors.
Does the Roberts Court, do they feel like they should not be under such a harsh spotlight, that they should just be able to do their work and not have people picking apart everything that they're doing?
Sure. I mean, doesn't everyone? Wouldn't we all like less criticism in our jobs?
Well, we live in a spotlight, you know.
So. That's right. You know, I think that we have a real problem in terms of what we, again, as the public are incentivizing. These Supreme Court justices, for the first time in history, have 24-hour, guards with them. They can't really go to restaurants anymore. They can't talk to people they don't know, or they might be secretly recorded and that recording taken out of context. So if you're a normal person with a young family, are you going to accept a nomination to the Supreme Court next time? Knowing the confirmation process, knowing the life that you'll sort of subject your family to. And I think we have, unfortunately, by protests at their houses and attacking their, you know, children, that we're not going to change these justices' minds. But what you are going to do is have sociopaths on the Supreme Court from now on, because they're the only people who are going to take this job.
So really quickly, I got about a minute here. If we have the Democrats, we're able to win in November control of the Senate, do you think we're going to have some snap resignations on the high court so that Trump can try to squeeze in new appointees?
I think that's unlikely, but I also think if Democrats take control of the Senate, we will not have any confirmations of judges for the rest of Trump's term.
And so we'll probably have eventually, because we have some justices who may want to retire or whatever, and a lot to follow. You'll have a lot to write about on SCOTUS blog, Sarah.
Thank you so much.
never going to stop for you. A last branch standing, Sarah Iser, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening in.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.